Just before Susan and I went on holiday, when we were not feeling as refreshed as we are now, I said to Susan, it was in fact as we went out the gate on our day off for a walk, I'm going to preach a sermon sometime on the subject, life is wearifying. In other words, that life and tiredness, life and mental strain, life and physical strain are inseparable. Well, here I am, sooner than I thought, and I trust no one will feel that the timing is insensitive, as if being well rested and returning to some of you who have not had a good rest, I was merely trying to crack the whip and say, now keep going, work harder, disregard the sweat and toil. Now, one thing I want to stress at the beginning in taking the subject is I don't want to seem to be making a virtue of tiredness. So please remember that in everything I'm saying. I'm going to be saying much about the inevitability of tiredness, but I don't want anyone to think that I'm making a virtue out of tiredness. Now, why take a subject like this? The reason is quite simply that it's neglected. First, the New Testament doesn't contain much teaching on tiredness. It's not one of the things that the believer is warned about. You don't find any statements, as you do, about things like sin and the danger of temptation and so on. Now, there are, of course, very vivid descriptions in the New Testament of tiredness. The most striking is Jesus on the Lake of Galilee. And we read that, Mark chapter 4, verse 38, we read it, and we forget what is involved in this, that Jesus was so tired when he came into the boat that he went and lay down on this pillow, the back of the boat, and immediately went to sleep. That is the reality, that he was that tired physically. He didn't do it just because he wanted the others to work at putting up the sails and himself have a rest. He was exhausted. You find this also with Jesus and the disciples. After they had been working in one place, they come back, and Jesus says, come away and rest a while. And then Mark adds this, for many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. They had no leisure even to eat. So the disciples too were involved in this experience of tiredness. Then too you have Paul in the New Testament describing his experience. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, I'll just read you some of the things that he says. I'm not giving you the whole list. It's a very long list, those of you that know it. But reading here from verse 25, three times I've been shipwrecked. A night and a day I've been adrift at sea, on frequent journeys, in danger from rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from Gentiles, danger in the city, danger at sea, danger from false brethren. And then this, in toil and hardship, through many a sleepless night, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. And apart from other things, there is the daily pressure upon me. Remember what I said about mental stress, mental tiredness? There's the daily pressure upon me of my anxiety for all the churches. Who is made weak? Who is weak and I am not weak? Who is made to fall and I am not indignant? So the New Testament does contain these examples of tiredness, but you don't have any mention of it. No attention is drawn to it. You are going to be tired, so beware. And as Christians, we can shrug off these examples and say, well, that was Paul's life. He was a great apostle. He was a call to great things. Or this was Jesus. Well, after all, his was the great mission. So, of course, he would be tired. And these examples don't really apply to the simple man, like myself, who's called just to an ordinary work. This is how we can bypass these examples of tiredness. Now, there's another reason why I think that the subject is neglected today, and that is that man outside the church, that is the non-Christian culture that surrounds us, has imagined that a life of weariness and labor can be overcome. Now, this is partly because of technology, that is, being able to make machines. So you have all your labor-saving devices. Is it a strain to do this? Make a machine. Is it a strain to do that? Make another machine, you see, and so on, until gradually the stress and strain of life is removed. So that you have this mentality, if I'm going to have any toil, any sweat of the brow, there's something wrong. I must have a machine. So partly it's because of that. We live in a technological society. Partly it's because the Bible has been completely forgotten. The Bible with this other message which we are going to come to. Even the memory of it has been bypassed now. Even the memory has gone, which did exist in, say, our grandparents' generation quite clearly. So some of the problems that we have today about work and so on, our forefathers just wouldn't have imagined possible. So some people blame technology for all the stress and strain of life, and they must suggest that we must return to the life of the peasant, free from machines, the simple life. Now they've forgotten what the Bible says, you see. They've forgotten what the Bible says, that we are going to have toil and hardship. And they imagine that if we just remove the technology, get away from it, that is what's complicated life, and return to the simple life of the peasant, then we'll be okay. There won't be all this stuff cluttering our lives. That is a lie. Now, those of you who've been here for some time will appreciate that I often speak of my reservations about the technological society in which we live. And I even feel guilty about having a motor car, personally. Now, I'm not saying that others should. But for myself, if I didn't have to get the children to school, we wouldn't have a motor car. And I do feel that it has not simplified life, but overall, because we have not used machinery properly, it has cluttered life, it's complicated life. I really do believe that. And so I'm not just making an overall attack on the counterculture when it says we're fed up with machinery, with technology. So many are fed up, and I would say with some justification. But when they think that they can get rid of the machinery, return to the life of the peasant, and then not have an experience of toil and hardship, they are deluded. They have forgotten what the Bible teaches about the curse in Genesis chapter 3. And I want you to turn to that, please. Genesis chapter 3, verse 17. Right at the beginning of the Bible, the first few pages, Genesis 3, verse 17. Now, Adam and Eve had been created perfect, and then, as you know, Adam and Eve rebelled against God, and God came to them, and this is part of the curse, the judgment that he made. Reading from verse 17. And to Adam God said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it will bring forth to you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. There he is stressing the plants as against the fruit of the tree. Things which had been provided and were valid for the animals, but which now man would have to resort to. Because the other was not adequate, that he would then have to labor with the soil to produce the grain from which he would eat. Of course, he would continue to eat the fruit of the trees. That is not excluded. But it's this emphasis upon the fact they're going to have to work for their food, as against it being provided gratis. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Now I feel that many of us too, the culture at large has forgotten it, and we too, those of us who believe the Bible, are in danger of forgetting this thing, this great truth that comes to us out of the Bible. Now, you find this in people being surprised, now I'm not speaking about others but myself, surprised to find life wearifying. We act as if life can be free of toil and trouble. And I mean, even in the area apart from sickness and sorrow, which is due to sin. I'm not speaking directly about that. Of course, that's involved. Sorrow and sickness, and all the other things which result from the fall. I'm thinking just of the existence of life. Of just living day by day. How are you going to get the food, etc., etc.? Where are you going to live? In that area, too, there is this experience of sorrow. In the sweat of your face, you shall eat bread. So, for the believer reading the New Testament, although there aren't reminders of the inevitability of getting tired on every page, there is this basis for all life in Genesis chapter 3, verse 17. The Bible doesn't need to draw attention to it in the New Testament. Why? Because this is something which runs right through man's experience from this moment in history. Rather like if you take a loaf of bread and you've got a knife and you've been cutting onions with it. Every slice of bread that you cut thereafter is going to have this taste of onion on it. You know the experience. And you just can't wait to throw that knife away. But that is what is the case with the Bible. The Bible doesn't reiterate this over and over and over again. Why? Because that great curse stands there. This is the judgment that God made upon man's evil, upon his rebellion. That every day this would be part of his experience. That in the sweat of his brow he would eat bread. Now even for the person who disregards the Bible, the modern atheist, the modern communist, whatever you like, whatever persuasion, the person who does not regard the Bible, and even though he has much technology to assist him, he can never remove this fact, in the sweat of your face you shall eat bread. So it's not just for the Christian, it is true for all men. Genesis chapter 3, verse 17, and God said to Adam, cursed is the ground because of what you have done. Now this leads us to the next point. What is our attitude then to work? Hearing all this, someone might be tempted to say, well, if work's going to be all sweat and tears, mate, I don't want it. That would be a reaction. This is what many people feel. And such a person will attempt then to avoid work of any kind at all costs. The Bible has a word for that kind of person, the sluggard. Now, we must be careful to clarify something here, which is very important. And there are two points which I feel are really important to clarify concerning work. The first is this. The Bible says that work is good because man was made a worker. So work did not come in after the fall. Listen to Genesis 1, 27, 28. God said after the creation of Adam and Eve, fill the earth and subdue it. Fill the earth and subdue it. There is a command involved there that they were to act in some way. They were to do something with their environment, to mold it in some way. Again in chapter 2 of Genesis verse 15, God put Adam in the garden to till it and keep it. Once again, there is activity, you see. So the picture of man created perfect is not of him sitting there in a beautiful easy chair, drinking lemonade, and sitting in the sun. Now, he may have had a great deal more of that than we have today. That's true. But this is not what he was made. He was made a worker. Now, this is the first thing that I feel has to be clarified. And I can't stress it too much. Work is part of being a man or a woman, of being a person made in the image of God. That is what the Bible teaches. So if you aren't working, then you are not living as a man. And hence Paul can say this very striking statement, if you analyze it, which we read in that passage in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. If a man does not work, let him not eat. Why does he say that? Is he just being vindictive? Is he saying, you're breaking the rules of society, mate, so no food? Is that his approach? It's much more profound. It seems to me Paul is saying, just as eating is part of life, which you cannot do without, it's constitutive of life, so work for a man is constitutive of life. And if he does not have it, just as if he does not have food, he will perish physically, so if he does not have work, he will perish psychologically. So that's the first qualification I want to make. Work is original. Work didn't begin with the fall. Work is good. Work is essential. What began with the fall is the toil, the sorrow, the discomfort of work. That is what the fall brought. It did not bring work. The second clarification is this. Even though the fall brought with it this curse on work, cursed is the ground, in toil you shall eat of it, in the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, this does not mean that all work is sorrow. It does not mean that all work is sorrow. Work was designed by God to satisfy man. Just as in God's own creation, when he created, when he worked, as it were, in making the universe, in making man, in making the animals, in making the trees, etc., God could say, looking at the result of his work, it is good. It was a pleasure to him. It was pleasing in his sight. So for man, when we work and we create something, we do something, we achieve something, it is pleasing to us, even though there is this curse upon man and upon work. Work is not all sorrow. There is much satisfaction in it. So the Bible mustn't be taken to mean that no work is satisfying. It simply teaches that while all work originally, that is, before the fall, was satisfying, now it is no longer the case. And unhappily, parts of his work are going to be a source of sorrow to him. They will make him uncomfortable, the sweat. They'll make him weary, and sometimes very weary. This is why I say, have taken the subject, life is wearifying. Let me use a parallel at this point to emphasize this point that even though there is this curse upon man and his work, his labor, not all work is therefore a sorrow to man. The Bible does not mean that in saying that there is this curse on work. In the beginning here, just the verses before Genesis chapter 3:17, there is the judgment made on the woman. Now, childbearing was made by God something to be of great pleasure and satisfaction to the woman and the man. But I'm thinking now specifically of the woman. The actual physical experience of childbearing was to be something of pleasure. There is then, after the fall, a judgment on the woman. And God says that she is to have suffering, pain in childbearing. So, although then there is this suffering, it does not remove the satisfaction of the experience of childbearing. And as so many have experienced, there is, to the contrary, there is great joy in bearing children. So there is the sorrow, but this doesn't make the whole thing sorrow. So with work, there is sorrow, there is discomfort, there is the sweat and so on, the discomfort, but it is not all there. Now, those are two important qualifications, it seems to me, concerning the curse of Genesis 3. So what attitude should we have to work, then, as Christians? First, we shouldn't regret it, but welcome it, because God made us as workers. We should welcome work, even though there is this experience of discomfort. Secondly, we shouldn't be surprised that life involves sweat and toil. So, some work that we do is immediately satisfying. But much work that we do is not immediately satisfying. It may be ultimately satisfying. Like the person who's creating something, he's making a beautiful picture, and he may have to labor long in doing it, or writing a book, or digging a garden. And there is labor in the actual process, which ultimately is very satisfying. But even though it isn't immediately satisfying, he is not surprised at the weariness and the discomfort. So just as we aren't surprised at the sickness or injustice or sorrow in life which surrounds us because of the fall, we aren't surprised at the fact that life and work are wearifying. And we understand why it's this way. And we accept the discomfort. Now, I don't mean we accept it fatalistically. I'm going to say something about that in a minute. But just try to think of the experiences of your everyday life. How do you receive them? The mother and father and their children. In the experience of bringing them up, of trying to take care of them, there are many times when it's wearifying. And it can only be described as that. Many times when you wish you could quit, you could just go lie down and rest, but it's not possible. But the mother and father are not surprised by it, point one. They know this is what life is going to contain. Point two, they aren't crushed by it and do then go on within this experience to real joy. Similarly, the gardener. The gardener digs his garden, and then he finds that there are weeds, And he watches his plants come up, and then he sees there are more weeds, and so he takes them down again, uproots the weeds. And all the time, he is struggling against this element in life, which is against him. This is what the curse involved. But he's not surprised by it. He's not crushed by it. And even though there is this, he looks through to the end of the whole process and knows that this work will be satisfying to him. Even if it's a very simple thing. Even like just making a little toy for a child. Or just clearing some part of the drive, or something like this. He knows that the end of the experience will be satisfying. So those two things, first of all. We shouldn't regret work, but rather welcome it. Knowing that as we do it, it will constitute us as man. And secondly, we shouldn't be surprised that life involves toil. Now, when I say we accept the discomfort and don't allow it to make us bitter, I don't mean that we become fatalistic. If we can find ways to ease the burden, that is not wrong. And some of the early scientists in the 17th century, men like Francis Bacon, who were Christians, a lot of their drive was, in trying to find out ways that they could control nature, was to ease man's burden. They stated this quite categorically, to try in some way to offset the effects of the fall. So if we can find ways to ease the burden, that's not wrong. Just as we aren't doing anything wrong to find ways to overcome disease and sickness. So to invent water pumps or lawnmowers or plows or tractors and so on isn't wrong. And we ought also to remember, as a very important parenthesis, that rest is not wrong either. So you shouldn't feel guilty as you feel tired, in the same way that Jesus said to the disciples, come and rest a while. Or as he himself went and lay down, there's no guilt in the taking of the rest. So both in making things which would ease the burden and taking rest from the labor, there is no guilt necessarily. But in making things to help us, we must always be careful that we don't try to eliminate the toil at any cost. So in other words, to have detergents which will make the washing up quicker, no matter what it does to nature. And to have various ways of producing things, no matter what it does to man. And so these big, ugly, smoke-belching factories, and men have to stand in this and hear this terrible noise and so on. So in the creating of the help to ease the burden, we have to be careful all the time to say, well, is this wise? Now, on some occasions, as for example with the detergent, if you cannot find a soap that will ease the burden, apart from destroying nature, making the rivers all fouled up, then you have to say, well, that's the way it's going to be. We're going to have to just toil and sweat a bit more until we can find something. We will not take this easy way out. So there's got to be great care in the finding of solutions to the toil and the labor. But the point I want to stress in all this is just this, simply, that we shouldn't be surprised to find the sweat and toil. There's too much of the utopianism in us. We are surprised by it. Now, we are naturally lazy. That's another problem. We're naturally lazy. That is something which is a sin, the Bible says. It said, so we read there in that passage that we are to admonish the idle. And Paul says some very strong things about the person who's not working. But that's another issue. I'm talking about the way you view your experience. Are you surprised at the sweat? Are you surprised at the discomfort? Now, of course, if anyone is attempting to be used by God for his work of redemption, of trying to rescue men from the sadness and sorrow of life, of course, then there will quite clearly be this discomfort. In the same way that Jesus was weary, so weary that he flopped down in the boat in broad daylight, so the Christian worker will have this in addition. Now, when I say the Christian worker, I don't just mean the missionary, and I don't just mean the minister. Every single one of us is a Christian worker. That is, we view our calling as well as being a gardener, let's say, or someone who helps in the laundry or whatever it might be. We view our calling as seeking to redeem this lost world. to bring in God's kingdom. And around you are people who are suffering to right and left. What are you to do about it? As you seek to be used by God, to present your body a living sacrifice unto him, this will of course be your experience. In addition to the toil and sorrow of just being a man, there will be this too, as Jesus had it, of the difficulty of living in a world which is in rebellion against God and seeking to redeem. Now, if you notice in the passage we read in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, Paul stresses this. He says to them, there are some who are living in idleness. And then he says how he lived. And he quite clearly was prepared to put himself out for the sake of these Christians. Now, some of them presumably were not Christians when he arrived and became Christians as a result of his ministry. But this is what he says. For you yourselves know how you ought to imitate us. We were not idle when we were with you. We did not eat anyone's bread without paying, but with toil and labor we worked night and day, that we might not burden any of you. Now the situation was simply this, that as a minister of the gospel, a servant of the gospel, when appointed to this work, he was free to be kept by the church. He didn't have to work. And that is the only exception the Bible knows. From the point of view of work, of a release from the ordinary work. Not, and I'd say this carefully, not because this means, well, the minister then is going to have an easy time. But because it seems to me the Bible views this work as so strenuous, just as it was for Jesus, just as it was for Paul, so strenuous that you cannot do the two things completely together. All of us, as I said earlier, are Christian workers. We, all of us, are able to use our spare time and so on to work to help others, of course. But I'm talking about the calling to be ministers, to be servants in the church. And the Bible views this as such hard work that the two things cannot be done simultaneously. And hence, there is the keeping by the church of this individual. So it's not as if it's just to release him from work so that he can have an easy time. But Paul's emphasis is here, even though I had this right, I was prepared to lay it aside to give you an example of how you also ought to labor. So you have here a reminder to the Christian minister of what life is going to be like. There's going to be weariness because of sharing the same kind of work that Paul had. But beyond that, he says he's giving an example to all. It was not because we have not that right, but to give you in our conduct an example to imitate. So, for all, there is this emphasis on the hard work. Now, of course, work can be used as a form of escape. And you can think of the executive, but it can be true of anyone. The person who uses work to escape from some of the other responsibilities of life, of his family, of his children. And that is an ugly thing. But what we need today, desperately, it seems to me, is to remind ourselves again of this statement right at the beginning of Genesis, which covers the whole of our experience, which will affect you day by day, even though the New Testament doesn't warn you of it, even though it doesn't mention it and draw attention to it, this experience of the curse upon Adam and Eve, that in the sweat of their brow they would eat bread. Now, too often we have forgotten it, and so we've been surprised by it. We need to recover this.